Hello and welcome to another bonus episode of the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, the Society's deputy director Dr. Robert Massey and producer Richard Hollingham.
This is the place where we dive into the supermassive mailbox and answer all of your fantastic questions that you sent in.
Yeah, but we've covered a lot of questions recently.
Okay.
So this episode, I'm bringing back the Space Book Club. But to be honest, I'm going to welcome exhibitions, film and TV recommendations.
Because oh, nice.
Some of us don't have time to read full books. And when I say some of us, I might mean me.
Yeah. And me.
But before we do that, I thought we could have a check-in because it's been 2 years since the first images from JWST. So I wanted to have a look at, you know, what's happened in those 2 years. What have been some of the latest discoveries? Because I think when we first had those images, we talked about Webb all the time. And we've moved on. We haven't checked in with them for a little while. So this is a good opportunity to do that. So what have been some of the latest discoveries that have caught your eye?
Shall I start? Yeah, I mean the one that strikes me is this ongoing Hubble tension, which is still, I guess, not going to be uncontroversial, but the discrepancy between the scale and the rate of expansion of the universe implied by Planck and looking at the cosmic microwave background and the overall structure and what we see in terms of the redshift of galaxies. So what JWST has done is looked at Cepheid variables, which are stars that vary in a very regular way. So essentially the rate, the period, the length of time over which they vary is related to their brightness. And therefore, if you see the variation, you know how bright they actually are. And then you compare that with how bright they appear to be. And hence, you know how far away they are. Now, it's done that in a galaxy 130 million light years away, which is much, much further than we've done before. And it still finds this tension. So it still finds that there is this discrepancy. It's not vast, but it's there. And it might mean things like dark energy is more powerful than we thought it was. And, all, you know, cosmologists love this kind of thing, I suspect, because it, you know, allows them to carry on developing ideas about the universe. But it's really fundamental.
I mean, it depends who you talk to, Robert, to be honest.
some people don't like it, I imagine.
A little bit of chaos, to be honest. I think there's two main groups that are looking at this with JWST at the minute. And one group says JWST still finds this difference between the two main methods we have for measuring the expansion rate of the universe, right? And JWST is focusing on one of them. And we thought with JWST it would explain the difference away, and it didn't. But then the other group, who technically haven't published a paper yet, but have been sort of presenting their results on the conference circuit this spring and summer, are saying JWST's got rid of this tension, and actually now they agree with Planck. these two different methods, so Planck being one of them and JWST's version being the other method. And so, I mean, we're all very confused.
Waiting for a definitive paper.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think that's what everyone's waiting for, so that they can dive into like what part of the problem did JWST change to make everything all of a sudden, you know, agree again with the rate of expansion you get out. So it's just, I mean, it's so funny when I talk to my cosmologist colleagues, because I am not a cosmologist. I never claimed to be one. It's very complicated. And you talk to them and they're all like, oh, I don't know. That's not my niche. I'll just let them figure it out. And so it's just these two teams that are trying to work on this. And you can just tell people are almost at like, they're almost impatient now. They're just like, could we just figure this out already? Okay, yeah. But yeah, not as clear cut as we necessarily hoped it would be.
Yeah, so my other one is easier, I think, at least conceptually, which is that there's a really nice image of the Horsehead Nebula that's just come up. One of my favourite objects. It's really hard to see with your eye, but lots of astrophotographers actually find it quite easy to take pictures of it. It's a dark nebula in the constellation of Orion, and it looks like a horse's head. And what JWST does is zoom in on the top of the mane of the head, if you like, of the horse. And it's a sort of super close-up. So it's looking at what you might describe as a small, by astronomical standards, 0.8 light years across section of the nebula. And it sees all the infrared light from the dust and soot there. So it's looking right inside one of my favorite objects. So I'm not sure that counts as a discovery, but it's something that I thought was a nice thing.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it was so nice. And did you see the image that came out from the Euclid Space Telescope as well of the horse head?
Yeah. I did. I mean, it's just this favourite target astrophotographers and for astronomers, for professional astronomers too.
And I think what was so wonderful is this, it showcased the strengths of each of the different telescopes of like Euclid, Hubble and JWST. So Euclid launched last year, and it's not a telescope like Hubble and JWST where, like, you know, us scientists can just apply to use it, you know, and if you're successful, you get the time and the data. Euclid is just sort of doing a survey of the sky. And so because of that, they've given it this huge field of view. So it looks at a much bigger region of sky at once. And so you have the Euclid image, which is massive, next to the Hubble image, which zooms in a little bit more because its field of view is smaller. And then JWST, which, you know, zooms in again with that super high resolution. And just seeing the three of them side by side is just amazing. I was blown away by that, those images.
And it's so nice just to compare them as well. It does just, it's just really exciting when you keep having those different points of view. And so, Becky, what about you? What are you excited about of, you know, the past 2 years of Webb?
Well, I mean, so I think it's funny with Webb. Webb was designed to, you know, really tackle the most distant universe. And then the exoplanet people, the community, were kind of like, ooh, infrared, that would be helpful for us. And they sort of piggybacked. So it's really fun to see how I think the two biggest areas that it's impacted on are the most, our understanding of the most distant universe and then our understanding of, like, exoplanet atmospheres. And so I've really been following those two the most. In terms of the distant universe, like, we had, like, the most distant supermassive black hole possibly found this month as well, which obviously I was very excited about because it helps us work out, like, what epoch of the universe did black holes first form and how big they were able to grow in such a short space of time in the very early universe. And what we're seeing is really confusing to us because it doesn't really make sense in terms of what we know about how black holes grow and when we think they form and how big they are when we think they form. So it's giving us lots of questions around that. And similarly, one of the big things that people have been talking about and sort of being confused about is what we sort of dubbed overmassive galaxies in the early universe. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't actually.
Yeah, so really distant galaxies that JWST has been finding that, like, we've confirmed, like, they are really that far away, right, with the light that we get from them. When we then work out their mass, so, like, from the light, you assume, like, okay, there must be sort of this spread of stars there. And so to account for that much light that we're getting, those stars, like, they, you know, there must be this many stars there in total and therefore this mass of stars. When we work that out, they're so much more massive than they should be. In terms of our models of how galaxies and stars first form in the universe, there's only, like, you know, you only have so much time to for everything to collapse and form and come together. So there shouldn't be galaxies that big at that time in the universe's history. And people are like, what?
When I saw it, and I think the latest one was, what, 1,600 light years across. So they're small by contempt by the present day universe, but presumably much bigger than the models say they should be, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that people have been trying to work out. Is there something wrong with our models, and can stuff form much quicker, or perhaps do stars, you know, form at much higher masses in the early universe? Is that possible? Like, there's sort of like an upper tail end of stars that we see in our own galaxy around about a few hundred times the mass of the sun, but could it be bigger in the early universe? Or I think the one that I'm most convinced by is that step that I said in the middle, is that you go from, you know, the amount of light that you see to the mass that you have. You have to assume there's some spread in the stars that you're seeing. So, like, some distribution of, you've got this many low mass stars and this many high mass stars, and you can draw a graph of, like, this is how many you get. And we get that graph from looking at stars in our own Milky Way. But that might not be the case. Again, there might be more massive stars in the early universe. It could be a different spread. And so if you have that different spread, that massively changes things. And there was a paper that came out last year showing that if you assume there's more heavier stars in the early universe, you know, and you skew that graph a little bit, then actually the masses that you get for the, you know, how much mass is there and with how much light we're seeing are much lower and do fit with our models that we have. So it could just be this spread of stars that we're, this is this assumption step in the middle. It's something called the IMF that always makes people laugh. It's the initial mass function, not the International Monetary Fund. It's the IMF. And so I think it's probably something to do with that, but it's so interesting to see how my colleagues have reacted to it, because we see this one, oh, massive galaxies, that's weird. Yeah, okay, so it's probably something to do with the IMF. There's some assumption that's wrong, versus, like, the media and the internet that are like, oh my gosh, the Big Bang is broken. No. So that's been really fun to sort of watch play out, and, you know, a headache to then try and explain, no, it's probably this. And then from the other end of the spectrum, the exoplanet stuff, I think that's been so exciting to see like JWST like come through on being able to get these exoplanet atmospheres, but B, also just watch the struggle in the exoplanet community as they deal with this data. I know, I think there was a lot of hype around the TRAPPIST system. Do you remember this system, like seven planets around a red dwarf star? I think, I mean, the fact that the data they're getting from them is so difficult to work with, I just don't think they're getting the signal. It sounds like they're probably just like rocky balls with no atmospheres, which is why we're just, you know, not getting anything from them.
Right.
But who knows? We'll wait for those papers to come out. The ones that have come out so far, TRAPPIST B and C, have just been like, it's just bare rock, probably. But then there have been other planets that, you know, they've been able to get the atmospheres from that have obviously caused some stir and some headlines. The big one was K218b, which was a planet that is sort of like super Earth mini Neptune, right? It's somewhere in between the two of them. And there was a claim last year that there was evidence for something called dimethyl sulfide in the atmosphere from the JWST data, which on Earth is produced by bacteria. And so it's long been thought it could be like a biosignature, like a signature that life was present in the atmosphere. And obviously, again, the media was like, oh my gosh, JWST's found evidence for life. Whereas, you know, the astrophysicist looked at the paper and was like, that's really weak evidence. It's not even like over the threshold with which we would claim we found something.
Right, okay.
Oh, if you use this different model, then it's not there. And oh, it could just be methane and not dimethyl sulfide because you find the signature of dimethyl sulfide in the same place as methane. And oh, we're going to need new data with JWST to check that. And all this kind of stuff that should be coming soon and hopefully should help us figure out what's going on with this planet. Because again, like, I think it's one of those things where if you're not careful as an astrophysicist with the press release that you put out on this paper, people are then like, when, you know, if we do actually find a biosignature that's much more strong of an evidence and we can be really sure of in the future, and people say, oh, the first biosignature found, people might be like, oh, didn't we already do that, you know, and be almost like blasé about it. So you have to be really careful with like how you communicate this stuff, because we really are, like you said, is we're just 2 years into JWST.
I was just thinking this. I was like, God, like, we've covered so much. I'm like, wait, this is 2 years. I mean, already the data that we're getting through is just insane levels of people even being able to get through it.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, I totally understand what you mean, that we have to be careful with what we communicate and how we communicate. But if you take a step back, it is just really exciting.
Oh, yeah.
It's just so it exciting. Is, it
is. Can I just put a shout out for Hubble at this point? Because, you know, old Hubble, it's been in orbit now since 1990. And okay, it didn't work to start with, but it got fixed in orbit, which was also a remarkable achievement. And it's just back in business. It's been had a few glitches over the last few months. It's now back in business with just one gyro working, which is what's used to sort of track and follow objects in space. But it's still working. And to have Hubble and the JWST at the same time, I just think, I mean, this is a golden
and
era, isn't it, of space astronomy?
Yeah,
totally. It really is. It really is. And I think that's why people are, you know, so excited about any new discovery that comes out and everything like that. It is just incredible. But I also think it's really been good to sort of like, you know, just talk about this as science in real time. Like, we're really living through the confusion. And in a way, that's almost more exciting than getting all of these clear-cut answers.
Yeah, totally.
Maybe that's just me, though.
I really like the phrase overmassive podcast. Yeah. I think that is great.
This is what this should be called.
Yeah, exactly,
the overmassive
podcast. Yeah.
Because it's the bonus episode, so that totally makes sense. Yeah.
I've written it down.
Oh, well, maybe we'll be changing the name.
Yeah.
Right, I'm going to move on and open up the space library.
Nice.
So what are you recommending for Space Book Club? Becky, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I read The Unseen Universe by Caroline Harper this past month, which I can be described as a JWST picture book, so I guess it is good for this episode. But, you know, it's all the stunning web images just printed so beautifully, and then they're explained with this very wonderful, like really accessible text, you know, a level that everyone can understand to explain all the images. So, you know, the images get more beautiful when you know what you're looking at as well, you know, which I always say that's That's my favourite thing. And Caroline Harper, who's the author, you know, she's head of space science at the UK Space Agency as well. So, you know she's got the expertise and the inside info for it as well, because she'll have been involved in, for example, like the MIRI instrument on JWST. So, yeah, it's a really cool book. I can highly recommend it for people. And then, Izzy, you said before that you would also take exhibitions, TV shows, film recommendations.
Yes, all
as well.
Are welcome. Okay, cool. Yeah, everything's welcome.
Well, and I've got to recommend the Moonwalkers exhibition at Lightroom in London. Have you seen this?
So good.
Yeah, it's one of those it's one of those rooms, people don't know, where you know where they've got like almost like projectors or TV screens around the entire room. So it's one of those completely like immersive room experiences. And this is like basically the story of the Apollo missions. So if you imagine all of the amazing images that were sent back from Apollo, imagine being immersed in those. So you feel like you're on the moon. So, so good.
I've been to it as well. We were lucky enough when we went to see it to sit next to one of the original Apollo flight directors, Jerry Griffin.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Of course you did, Richard.
Of course we did. Who we interviewed for the Space Boffins podcast. He was amazed by it as well. He enjoyed it. And he was part of it. I think the bit for me, it's not just the stunning images, and they're even more stunning now thanks to the work of Andy Saunders, who's done these amazing advancements. Yeah. But there is a point in the show where you're in Mission Control, and where you're sitting, you're suddenly at a console in Mission Control, and sitting next to a flight director in Apollo Mission Control was just extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. So yeah, thoroughly recommend
it. We probably need to stress to visitors that they won't all get Apollo.
No,
flight.
I think that
which is a shame, you know. One book I have read and one I haven't, and these were both sent to me for the podcast. So the first one is The Possibility of Life by Jane Green, and it's she's a US author, and she writes really, really well, I think, about the way in which we might respond to it and the different discoveries that have shaped it, and it includes things like the putative detection of phosphine on Venus. So I do recommend that, and it's a really intriguing way of thinking through it. So she sort of describes, she imagines how humanity reacts, the kind of processes we go through. So if you've ever wondered about that, then I recommend it. And of course she also talks about the signatures we're looking to try and understand whether there is life, you know, the biosignatures, all these things that make it, you know, I mean, we're looking really for tentative detections a lot of the time and then trying to confirm them. So I really strongly recommend that.
What I'm hearing is that it's like, if contact really happened, like,
she does reference that. Yeah, she references science fiction a lot as well. And she kind of talks about the different ways it's imagined and in fairly recent books as well. So I'd, I'd recommend that. The other one is one by Richard Ellis, who actually won a medal, actually various medals in the Royal Astronomical Society and lots of others. And he's a long-standing cosmologist and galaxy guy. And he's written a book called When Galaxies Were Born and The Quest for Cosmic Dawn. And he talks about, to some extent, it's autobiographical. So it's talking about the 40 years of science and what it took to get to where we are today to understand them. And of course, you know, as we've heard from JWST, it's actually still, you know, this isn't over. It's not completed science by any means. But it's really interesting to see how he tracks it right the way through from, say, the 1970s, 1980s to where we are today.
Nice. Okay, well, I'm going to break the rules of book club and recommend a podcast, because that's how I roll.
not this one.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I recommend the Supermassive podcast to everyone, but that is a biased opinion. So I'm now going to recommend Crash Course Pods, The Universe. So this is where Dr. Katie Mack, who we've had on the show before, you know, she's the theoretical physicist behind The End of Everything, astronomically speaking. In this series, she goes through step by step the history of the entire universe with a best-selling author, John Green. So they've done the beginning of the universe, sort of the fundamental forces, the dark ages of the cosmos, and then, you know, the birth of stars, and they've called it When Stars Turn On. So it's just a nice little guide through the universe. When you're missing us, you can jump over to that podcast series. And obviously, if we're recommending podcasts, then we also have to mention Space Boffins.
Yes, thank you very much.
Hosted by the one and only Richard Hollingham.
In fact, our May podcast, I think, is the best one we ever did, because we have astronaut Victor Glover, who is extraordinary, and also the extraordinarily named Mason Angel, who's made his money in finance and had a Blue Origin flight recently. And the two of them together are just extraordinary. So it's a great podcast. Sorry to end on a bit of a downer, but I want to recommend a book called Challenge. Challenger, the true story of heroism and disaster on the edge of space. So I've seen it advertised a lot in the UK. I don't know whether that's true in the US as well. It's by Adam Higginbotham. I think Higginbotham. And it's really, you know, around the events of Tuesday, January the 28th, 1986, with the explosion of the Challenger space shuttle, killing all seven crew, including the teacher, Krista McAuliffe. And it's a gripping account. I knew a lot of this stuff before, and most of it, I would say, has been written before. But you really feel the way he's written it, and it's extensively researched. You feel you're in these meetings where these flawed decisions were made, and this, you know, insight into this incompetent management, the political pressure, the media pressure under launching Challenger. And quite a lot of foreshadowing, you know, the problems with the tiles on the orbiter, the fundamental design of the orbiter, the problems with these solid rockets. I mean, the whole system was pretty flawed in its design, but it's really well written. It's not overly gruesome. It doesn't dwell on the aspects of the disaster particularly. And it really just, it's shocking in terms of just laying out the incompetence behind the disaster and many of the same mistakes made then later with Columbia. But really good read. I did take it on holiday. Really good read and pretty gripping and nicely documented, laid out. And yeah, you just feel you were there and you just feel, no, don't make that decision. Don't do that. Why are you doing that? It's incredibly frustrating all the way through. But very, very, very good. Very good book. It deserves the publicity it's getting.
Mm. And similarly, like there was, I saw it on BBC. I think it might have been an American produced programme, but it was called The Space Shuttle That Fell to Earth, which was a doc on the Columbia disaster. And it was aired, like, I think it was back in March.
Yeah, it's on iPlayer, yeah.
It's three episodes. And again, that's so similar. It's this gripping documentary that actually interviews people who were making the decisions as well. And it's one of those things where you can just see at every single stage, you're just there, like, screaming at the TV, like, no, like, make a different decision, you know? It's so powerful when you watch it.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. And I mean, you're seeing now, at least with NASA's new, or Boeing's new spacecraft, Starliner, which has been very much delayed and launched recently, the caution, you know, let's hope those lessons have been learned. The caution in taking it step by step and only launching when they're ready and not giving in to that pressure. And I think particularly with NASA, it's that political pressure to launch at all costs.
Well, yeah, a bit of a downer, Richard.
But yeah, sorry. But I'm very much looking forward to developing the Overmassive podcast. So, you know, that's a
plus. Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
Well, thank you for all of those recommendations. I'm going to put all of them in the show notes. So if you want to get any of those books, then that's where you can find them.
And we'll be back in a few weeks' time with an episode all about Venus. And until then, everybody, happy stargazing.